Community Conversations with Community Centres SA. Here's Kerry Ackermans.
Have you ever wondered how they train dogs to be muster dogs? Well, we're going to be very fortunate today to be talking to Lisa Miller, journalist and reporter and now novelist who started her career in the Gympie Times in 1988. She's won a Walkley Award in 2005 for investigative reporting, has some amazing stories, and will share with us what it was like to work with the muster dogs and to write a book. Lisa, what an amazing career you've had. You've worked over in both London and Washington, D.C., covering some of the world's biggest stories, and you've returned back to the ABC in Australia. You're now presenting ABC News Breakfast, but what I'm really interested in, and I'm sure our community will be, is muster dogs. What on earth led you to fall in love with five border collies?
It is amazing that I get to do this, and it is part of my job, and I get paid for it. I still pinch myself, Kerry, that this has happened. And it came about by sheer chance. The Muster Dogs producers are an outside company. They're not part of the ABC. They had pitched this idea about sending out, well, initially with the first series, the Kelpies, and then the second series, the Border Collies, and sending them to trainers all around Australia. The ABC loved it, but they felt like they wanted a voice that was connected to regional Australia to narrate it. And they knew that I had grown up in country Queensland, that mum and dad had been dairy farmers back in the day, and that I still had a very strong connection to the bush. So they rang me on a Friday afternoon in the middle of COVID lockdowns in Melbourne when life was feeling a bit miserable, and they said, "Do you want to narrate a show about dogs?" And I said, "Dogs?" And that's where it all began. I did the first lot of narration in a audio booth in Melbourne with one of the producers on her parents-in-law bedroom in Brisbane, where she was trapped across the border. Another person in Sydney, they were all on Zoom watching me and listening and checking that the narration was going as they had hoped. And then it all went to air, and it was just this mega success that it was our wildest dreams that so many people tuned in on that first night.
What do you think has attracted so much attention and interest from people and from viewers?
Do you know what? I think initially, because it came out in the COVID period, that people were able to vicariously travel with the beautiful landscapes that we were offering them on Muster Dogs. So we took them to Joni and Atisha in WA and up to CJ in the Northern Territory and down to Rob in Victoria. But the thing that kept coming through was that as the world was getting nastier, especially online, and people were ripping into each other, here was this very authentic, honest, kind, respectful show. And I think that is what really appealed. Sure, puppies are great, and people love the dogs, absolutely give you that. But I think it was this sense that it was a reality TV show that wasn't really a reality TV show. No one was getting the knives out. Everyone wanted the others to do as well as they could do. And that just fed through into our viewership. It filled people with joy. And they came away from watching an episode of Muster Dogs feeling happier about the world and happier knowing that kindness and joy could still make you be a winner, which is what happened with Frank Finger in the first series. I mean, he was the warmest, loveliest person, and he comes out as the winner, the champion muster dog with Annie.
And Lisa, it's interesting that you say that about that kindness and reality TV shows, because if we use reality TV shows to show the good side of humans, for example, if we take Survivor, if they all work together and the team got the prize, but it does end up being dog eat dog, except I think dogs are much nicer to each other than humans. So I do understand what you're saying about that. And of course, with our community centres across the state, but do you think it is that sense of country that brings community together, that there's something special about being in the country?
Well, there is definitely that. We had as many city viewers as we had country viewers with Muster Dogs. So there was a real appeal of people in the city looking at these communities and how they worked. For me, I mean, the town that I grew up in, Kilkeven, has a population of about 600 people. I'm still super close to people in that town, including my grade one teacher, who lives a couple of doors down from the school where she taught me 51 years ago. So there's that kind of connection that I think that comes through for me that I can help deliver to the audience as well. And there was certainly a bit of wistfulness about seeing these communities for people who were stuck in their city homes, and especially during lockdown. And you saw it. You saw the number of people who were then making decisions to go and live in the region. So, yeah, there was, I think it was a learning experience, Kerry, for both sides, that people in the country kind of were able to explain themselves a little bit and feel like they had a voice, and they were seeing themselves reflected on screen. And then you had the city folk who were like, wow, okay, so these people aren't being awful to their animals, and there are farmers out there who are trying to look after the landscape and the environment, and I see what they're doing here. So it was just one big school lesson, wasn't it, Kerry?
Well, absolutely. And interestingly, that I was listening the other day to an interview saying that the dogs are worth more than people. They've really gone up in value now, and they always want to get to work. Unless they're really sick, they're out there every day without complaint.
Yeah, so Joni Hall, our participant in WA in the first series, used to joke that, you know, her dogs can't take her to the HR department. But she would always say she's jesting, because they never would anyway. She was the kindest trainer with those dogs and loved every single one of them. The dogs are, they say that at least one dog is worth two or three workers. And the reason why we need them and we need these great dogs is we just can't get the people out into the regions that are needed to do the farm work that we had in the past. So these dogs are helping out, especially family farmers who are still wanting to stay on the land and not sell up to the big corporations. They need these dogs to help them be able to round up 300 head of cattle to get them in for their vaccinations and all the rest of it. So they are very much needed. But yes, I did track down for my book, because with the book Muster Dogs, that covers series one and series two, and it's all the behind the scenes things that we didn't have time to share on screen, and a lot more of the people story. So we got an understanding of the lives that they had lived. But I tracked down who had bought the most expensive Kelpie in Australia at that time. And, oh gosh, I could even remember the name of the dog. The dog was called Capri Eve, and it was a sheep farmer in New South Wales who'd paid in excess of $30,000.
Goodness.
And, of course, now I think the record got broken again, and it's something like $40,000. But I would have some nervousness about this, because dogs are great. No matter how much you look after them, they can still get themselves into a bit of strife, you know. And this is why Neil McDonald, the trainer on Muster Dogs, would be so adamant about keeping the dogs protected in cages and to make sure that they were looked after when they were traveling on the back of a ute. There was nothing that would upset Neil more than seeing a dog that didn't have a proper tie, or it had a loose tie, so if it fell off the ute, that would be terrible. You know, it could end up strangling itself. So there was a lot of consideration that went into all of that in the filming and then when I was writing the book. But yes, Capri Eve was the most expensive Kelpie at the time when I was writing it, and already we're talking about more money again.
A great piece of information. And Lisa, talk to us about that leap from being a reporter journalist to novelist.
Oh boy. Well, I was asked a few times when I was overseas if I would consider writing a book, and I said no, partly because I had no time, especially in my last few years in London, because it was in the thick of all of the terrorist attacks that were happening at the time. The London Bridge attack, Westminster, Manchester Arena, the Ariana Grande concert when kids were hit, and the Paris attacks. And so I was going from one to another and feeling like my cup was so full of grief and trauma. And the thought of sitting down and writing something, well, I didn't even have time. And when I came back to Australia, I moved to Melbourne to take up this job as co-host of News Breakfast, and then COVID hit. And suddenly I was a long way from my family in Queensland, and I had, you know, a couple of kilometres that I could roam. I'd go into work at 3 a.m. every day and be home by 9:30, and that was it. And the publisher rang and said, well, you've got no excuse now. You've got all
get
the
on
time
with it.
In the world, so how about it? And that was the just incredible Louise Adler, who's quite famous in the literary world, and she got me through it. And so that was the first book I wrote, which was called Daring to Fly, which was a memoir about my years growing up in the bush and then developing a terrible fear of flying, which was going to derail my hopes of becoming a foreign correspondent. And then, of course, the wild, wild roller coaster ride that was 20 years of being overseas, back and forth between Australia. And then the second book, well, I just had to crack on with that, Kerry. They said, we need a Muster Dogs book. We need 75,000 words in 4 months. And I took a big gulp and I got a bottle of glue and I glued my bum to the seat and I didn't move until I'd finished writing 75,000 words. It was hard.
That is a phenomenal task. And people don't realise that writing is a discipline. It's just not something that just flows out.
No, and you can't sit there waiting for the creativity to strike. You can't think, oh, do I feel like writing today? Do I feel like I have words inside me? It's like, nope, you have to write 1,200 words before you go to bed. Every single day, I would write 1,200 words and just tick off those days. And some days, the words weren't my finest. Other days, I'd go, oh, that's not bad. But you knew at the end, you'd have some terrific help in a copy editor and the publisher, and they'd pull it all into shape, and there you go. There's a book on the shelf, and I still look at it and think, did I actually do that? It was such a blur. That was last year as I was writing it.
It's such a great book. I'm talking to Lisa Miller, journalist and novelist, and the popular show Muster Dogs. If you haven't seen it, it's a must. And, of course, to read Lisa's book. And Lisa, I think what you did was to bring that show to life in people's minds, because when you watch a show, it's all done for you. When you read a book, you create it yourself.
Oh, thank you, Kerry. I really wanted people to have a glimpse of the lives of these wonderful participants, and wonderful things happened along the way. If I can share a story with
Please do. Well,
Kerry in Winton, who was the partner of Steve Elliott, who was in the wheelchair and had the dog Indy, Kerry was telling me about the birth of her premature son 20 years ago, and she was on a property near Julia Creek, and it was a terrifying moment for her, and the Royal Flying Doctors came in and they had to put lantern lamps along the runway to enable the plane to then take off with her and the baby that she swaddled in a towel with an oxygen mask over its face all the way to Cairns, and then she went straight into ICU. And she was there in Cairns by herself with the baby for 4 months. And when she told me this story, she said, there was a beautiful nurse on that plane, and I never got to thank her because she left straight away and I was in ICU. And I thought to myself, you know what, I'm going to try and track down that nurse for Kerry. Not for the TV series, not for the book, not for any reason other than being around all these kind people made me want to try and do kinder things. And it took me months and months because this nurse had long left the Royal Flying Doctors. She'd gone from kind of various jobs. She'd ended up at a company that was hugely private, and they were not going to even admit that she was there or confirm to me that they were passing on my messages. And I didn't want her to panic that a journalist was trying to track her down. So I was trying to explain why. And finally, she called me about 5 months after I started the search. And she said, oh, my name is Amy. I think you're looking for me. And I could have cried.
I would say, what a great moment.
And I hadn't told Kerry that I was looking for the nurse at all. And I rang Kerry and I said, you know how you wanted to thank the nurse that was on the plane? Well, I found her. And Kerry just started having a bit of a cry. And to be able to put the two of them together was just, when you talk about community, Kerry, that is the kind of community that I love being a part of, and I love thinking that if in some small way I was able to contribute to it.
Isn't it amazing, Lisa, how people come together? And you've raised just in our chat today about grief and loss and events that happen and tragedies, and there you are trying to help somebody thank someone. It's very evident that grief and loss happens to all of us at some time in some way in our lives, and you would have seen more than your fair share of it. When I was reading through all of the stories that you've covered worldwide, it's just phenomenal. What's your take on how human beings handle grief and loss?
Oh, well, we're all very different. And I went to a funeral just the other day of the sister of a very dear friend of mine, and she was only 62. And my friend said, "I'm going to try and hold it together today." And I said, "Why? Why do you feel you need to hold it together?" I feel like we have been and can be slightly judgmental of how people process grief. And I feel that over the years, the one thing I've learned is that you can do it any damn way you want to do it. If you want to go and hide away for a month or two or three, you do that. Like, who says, who makes the rules about dealing with grief? For me, because I was covering all these stories, especially in London, I mean, look, I'd had some doozies in the US where I covered the Haiti earthquake where 110,000 people died, and I covered school shootings. And being in place at a place like Sandy Hook, where you know 20 small children have been killed just hours earlier, there's nothing about being a journalist that teaches you to deal with that kind of stuff. By the time I got to London and all the terrorist attacks started happening, what I did was just bottle it up. I mean, I can remember the day my father died. I was in Ireland and I was standing in a park doing a piece to camera. And my sister had rung me. My dad lived to a wonderful old age, but I loved him dearly and I didn't want to lose him. And I was standing there doing a piece to camera and my sister rang and said, "I think tonight will be the night. I think tonight is when we're going to lose Dad." And she was ringing me from Australia. And I said to the camera operator, "Can we keep filming this piece to camera and get this story done? Because later tonight, I don't want to be working." But the fact that I still felt the need to kind of finish the job, I could compartmentalize. So I found dealing with grief and trauma easier by putting things in a box and then allowing myself to process them after. And that doesn't work for everyone. And neither should people feel the pressure to do it that way. That is the only takeaway that I have, Kerry, and I know that I've spoken quite a bit about it and probably gone longer than you anticipated, but I just feel that people should be able to grieve however they damn well like.
No, I was really keen to have your comments because we are actually developing a grief and loss program for community centres where people can come, meet with others and be supported to hold the space, because often people do just push it down, aren't allowed to air it. Even look with pets, companion animals, where, oh, it's just your dog. But for some people, best unconditional love you'll ever get. They can't express it. So we're actually doing it. So I'm really pleased to hear you talk about grief and how it impacts and what people do with it.
Yeah. I think that it's great to give people suggestions. If people are looking for ways to find their way through the grief, terrific. Give them those suggestions. But I would hate to be judging anyone for not grieving in a way that society thinks they should grieve.
Very individual, isn't it? And it's just allowing that space for people to be how they want to be. Whatever it
might. Yeah, and in Daring to Fly, the memoir that I wrote, I did write about the loss of one of my very dear friends who was an ABC cameraman who died in a helicopter crash, which was well publicised at the time in 2011, I think it was. And that, I was overseas in Washington at the time, and he'd been my flatmate, and we were still dear friends. And losing him was just shocking. I wanted to be around other people who knew him. And I was very grateful that the ABC, there was no question at all, the ABC knew that John had a couple of friends who were overseas in postings, foreign postings, and they just flew us home. No question. They just said, "Get on a plane, come home. You need to be with friends." And I loved that. And I'm always grateful that the ABC, and it was Kate Tawney, who was the news director at the time, that she made that call.
And it was a great call because you do need to be able to spend that time, share with others. As you said, and that's that thing of being able to talk about it. If that's what you want to do and have someone who will just listen.
Yeah. Exactly. Do you know my middle name is actually Joy? We're talking a lot about grief and trauma. I'm actually a very joyful person, Kerry.
Well, do you know you probably need all that joy to get through life?
Yeah, I do. People ask me why I am forever a glass half full kind of person. I'm super optimistic. You can present me with the worst story or situation and I will find a way to find the silver lining. And even if it's that I've learned a life lesson and therefore it's a silver lining. And I don't know why I am that way. I just am. And I do think it has helped me deal with so much of what's gone on in my life, both personally and the work that I have done. Which I was on a plane the other day and the gentleman in front turned around and he said, "You won't remember me, but you interviewed me the day after the Paris terrorist attacks outside the Bataclan Club." And I said, "Wow." I said, "I don't remember you. I'm sorry. What's your name?" And he told me what his name was. And he said he had a flat very close by and people who'd been injured had all kind of run and he'd opened the door and brought them in as the terrorists were still shooting people. And I said, "Oh, I'm grateful and amazed that you remember me." And he said, "Well, you were the only person who actually asked me about the trauma I had suffered." And I just thought, wow, isn't it that incredible that you never know when something you do is going to be the thing that makes a difference in someone's life. And to have him say that 9 years on, I was so profusely grateful to him. I said, "I have so many doubts about things that I've done over the years and if I could have done it better and if I'd treated people as well as I could have treated them as a journalist. I have so many doubts like that." And to have him say that to me, well, I walked off that plane with a skip in my step.
And so you should have, Lisa Miller. You've got an outstanding life story. And I just can't even imagine, no other name but Joy would have suited you, I think. Perhaps it should have been your first name.
Oh, yeah, I do love it. I just feel like I've grown into it over the years as well and thought a lot about it and thought how wonderful to have an emotion as your middle name.
Fabulous. And you will have brought a lot of joy to our listeners. Now, Lisa, the book is available on Amazon and now on audio. I listen a lot to audio, so
yes,
great way to listen.
It is, yep. And you can buy it at your bookstores or Booktopia, wherever you want to get it, and also at the library. I love libraries, so a lot of people are finding it a bit tough to spend money on things like books, so head to the library and put a request in for it.
And last question for you, is there another book in you?
Oh, not this year. We'll see. I'm having a wonderful 2024, enjoying reaping the joyful benefits of the hard work of the last 35 years. So I'm really having a ball at the moment.
Well, Lisa, it's been delightful to speak with you. I'd love to have heard all those stories from the 35 years, but thank you for sharing what you have done on our podcast, Community Conversations, today.
Thank you, Kerry, for the invitation.
And thank you for listening and engaging with our Community Conversations today. Every week, we aim to bring you stories from far and wide, across South Australia and beyond. People who are game changers in our community, doing great work, plus general topics of community interest. If you have any subjects you think we should cover or any other feedback, please let us know at communitycentressa.asn.au and feel free to share this podcast so we can engage more people in our next community conversation.
Community Conversations. For more information, check out communitycentressa.asn.au.